Blog Talk Radio.
Eraserhead, The Elephant Man, Dune, Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Twin Peaks, Lost Highway, The Straight Story, Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire. Welcome to a very special two-hour episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight's broadcast will be the first in a quarterly series of shows dedicated to exploring the works of some of the most talented, unique, and inspiring filmmakers of our time. Tonight, we pay tribute to David Lynch, with the industry craftsmen who have worked with him and the people who know him best. Welcome to our show, everybody. This is Jamie, and my fellow movie geeks are here with me, Jerry and Chris. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Jamie. Hey, everybody listening.
We're really excited to bring the show to you. We have a jam-packed 2 hours ahead celebrating David Lynch, who is an absolute favorite director of all three of ours. So what do you say we get started, guys?
Sounds good.
Okay, we start tonight's broadcast with Toby Keeler, a multi-talented filmmaker who has known Lynch for the past 47 years. In 1965, Lynch heeded the advice of Keeler's stepfather and entered the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, which marked Lynch's first foray into the world of filmmaking. In 1977, Keeler appeared in Lynch's cult classic Eraserhead, and 20 years later, in 1997, he produced and directed a documentary about his friend entitled Pretty as a Picture, The Art of David Lynch. Through his company, Fine Cut Presentations, Toby produces a variety of TV and web-based programs in addition to his documentary projects. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Toby Keeler. Toby, are you there?
Yeah, hi, fellas.
Hey, thanks so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure.
How did you first come to meet David Lynch?
Well, I guess the story goes it was in the front yard of a girl, David's girlfriend, at age 15, and I guess he was on the way out and I was on the way in, but we met there, and I think the first day he asked me, what my father did, and I told him he was a painter.
Right.
And that kind of changed everything. And, we became fast friends and, went through high school together. And over the years, we lost contact, but, came together again. And it's, it's a long time, man, since 1960.
Yeah, it's a long relationship.
1960,
that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't he say that you stole his girlfriend, too, at the time? That
I don't know if he'd put it that way. But that was the point of contact, was a lovely young lady named Linda.
Right.
And was there in Alexandria, Virginia, and like I said, we were in the same high school fraternity, and there's some good stories back from those times.
Yeah. Now, Dave, I had read interviews with Mr. Lynch where he actually said that he had never considered that you could actually make a career out of being an artist until he got to know your stepfather. And that was the big epiphany for him and what ultimately drove him to pursue it as a career. That's correct?
Well, I think that's true. Both he and Jack Fisk.
Yeah.
When you're 15, you're kind of don't know where you're going. At least most people don't. But David was one guy who had a direction, and you know, he'd rather paint than go out with the guys.
Yeah.
And he actually rented his first studio from Bushnell, my stepdad.
Yeah.
There in Alexandria, I think it was off Henry Street, and then he had another one on Cameron Street later. Mm. And you know, I remember those days. You know, I remember them well. I remember the night that Kennedy was lying in state in the Capitol, and you know, we were up in David's studio having a couple of beers, and we decided, well, let's go down and look at the casket lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda. So we jumped in Dave's family car and headed into town, and of course the lines went from the Capitol down to 16th Street and then back again, and we stood in line all night long, you know, with blankets wrapped around us to keep us warm. This was, you know, obviously in November,
right.
And I remember one person in line commenting that he said, "Are you brothers?" And I said, "Well, no," but David said, "We're from the same tribe."
Didn't David usher at JFK's inauguration?
Well, I think he did, actually. He was an Eagle Scout.
Right.
And that may have been when he was still in the Boy Scouts. I didn't know that. But I think he has the story where he was outside of the White House, and he saw the limousine pulling out with three living presidents. It was Kennedy and Nixon and Johnson.
Mm. Wow. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about his background and get your take on something. He was born in Montana, and he moved around a lot. And his father was a agricultural research scientist, and his mother was an English tutor, I believe.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
And it seems like a painfully kind of normal upbringing. So what is it about, your take on it, these kind of normal origins that he had that inform his work as an artist and a filmmaker?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, David is about, I mean, despite what people might think of his work is, besides being extremely bright and intuitive, he's about as normal a guy as you'd ever want to meet. He laughs a lot. He always has. I remember one summer David had needed a merit badge for Eagle Scouts for community service, and at the time there was a kind of a fad of running around the neighborhood and stenciling people's house numbers onto the side of the curb for, I think we charged a buck or something like that. And so David saw a great opportunity to make a little money and get his merit badge credit at the same time. But as to answer your question, I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah, because it seems like such an idyllic kind of upbringing that he had, and you see his films, and you know, obviously there's a lot of emotion and power and love in his films as well, but they're pretty dark. So I guess that's the bulk of the question, is where that kind of comes from.
Well, pretty dark is a good way to put it.
That's to be sure.
But with David, it always is and always has been, about the idea.
Right.
And here's a guy, that falls in love all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a piece of furniture or a painting, or a film. And with him, it's all about being, true to the idea.
Yeah.
And I guess that's Midwestern folks, have a tendency to kind of be straight shooters. And, David is a straight shooter. And, I think he likes to evoke mood. And, of course, darkness is one way of doing that.
Yeah.
But when you hang around the guy, you know, he'll tell stories that'll have you on the floor doubled over with laughter. There's no darkness in his life at all.
Wow.
That I can see. I mean, you know.
Well, I want to talk to you about the documentary you made of David Lynch. It's called Pretty as a Picture, The Art of David Lynch. One of the high points of it for me was the kind of reunion of sorts that took place at the original locations where Eraserhead was filmed.
Yeah.
Now, you were a part of that production back in the 70s. I know it was a very arduous, slow production. It took about 7 years to complete, I believe. How present were you during that time, and what memories stick out for you the most from that shoot?
Well, you know, I moved out here in 72, so I think David was already at the AFI, and I think he's probably already starting Eraserhead. You know, our contact was initiated by the fact that, you know, I called him, and he basically needed some crew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had Fred and Catherine and Jack and some other folks, Charlotte and the gang down there, you know, working, you know, all through the night and sleeping during the day. And you know, he needed some help for the man in the planet scene. And he needed some characters for the fighting man scene, which I appear in. And it's not just myself. I Dolores, my wife, and my two kids, Jennifer and Brad, although I think he may have cut them out, but they're in the credits as well. You know, it was just... you know, it was great to see an old friend, and, you know, I'd never, you know, I came out here to go to Cal Arts, and here was a great opportunity to come down and, you know, see an old friend, you know, working on his film project.
So how much time did you spend with him on the set for that project?
Well, you know, a couple of days, maybe, that's all. You know, over a period of time, I think there was another scene where the fetuses drop out of the sky on a stage. I forget where that scene comes, but, you know. What else can you say? Fetuses
right.
dropping out of the sky like rain.
That's all there is.
It's been in so many movies since then. That,
yeah, right.
At this point, you know.
But, you know, I'll never forget, you know, the after all those years. I mean, the film was dark, went dark for a number of years. You know, well, David was either out of money or you know, doing something else. And I know, you know, some scenes that he shot with Jack Nance were, you know, like separated by like 5 years.
Mm.
And you know, he was concerned that Jack would be able to match, but they, you know, it's seamless. And he was working with Alan Splett at the time. And I'll never forget the night they had the screening at the AFI, you know, cast and crew screening. And, you know, David's not one, he doesn't like being in the theater when his stuff's being shown.
Right.
At least he used to be that way. I don't know if he's gotten over it or not. But, you know, he likes to kind of sneak out. And it was a double system, so it was, everything was still kind of, you know, timed and all that, and the film came to an end, and it didn't have any music at the end, and it just went to black,
mm-hmm.
and there was silence, and there was more silence, and then people kind of just started getting up, and there was more silence, and they started walking out of the theater, and David thought everybody hated it. And, you know, we all kind of assembled in the room next door for some refreshments, and it was only then that, you know, people started, you know, that David found out that, oh, indeed, the opposite was true, that people were just completely spellbound by seeing this. I mean, we all knew at the time that, you know, here is cinematic genius at work. And, you know, it's still, without a doubt, I think it's still my favorite David Lynch picture. That, and I think Blue Velvet is probably
right. I'm sure that they felt that they had never seen anything like it before. And that's the one thing about David Lynch's films. They're not derivative of other films. You definitely have not seen them ever before.
Well, seen or heard.
Right.
You know, David has always been really picky about the sound. And rightfully so, because there's two senses working here.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about that too, because there's a section of your documentary that shows David in the studio with Angelo Badalamenti.
Yeah.
Longtime composer.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about his use and his understanding of music and sound?
Well, David, when we were in high school, he played the bongos. David's got the fastest fingers of anybody alive, man. He can fly on a set of bongos and congas, like you just wouldn't believe. But I'm not sure that he reads music. He just understands it, and when he hears it and he sees it, he knows, because he's so true to the idea, that he knows when it's right and when it's not.
Right.
And Angelo and he are kindred spirits in that regard. I mean, there's one of my favorite sequences in Pretty as a Picture is where they're working together in the studio in New York, working out an idea. And David comes up with a couple of notes and Angelo will play them out and they'll work on it, and that's basically the way it sort of comes together.
Yeah, perfect creative partners.
Right.
Well, yeah, they are, and they're both great guys. I mean, Angelo was most, the soundtrack for my show, basically was the soundtrack, a lot of outtakes from Lost Highway.
Mm-hmm.
That I went over, was privileged to go over and watch being recorded in Prague.
Well, it does take place during the shooting of Lost Highway, your documentary.
Yeah.
So what kind of observations did you make about the way he controls a set and he works his whole creative process in general?
Well, the people that David gets around him, the sense of team and the sense of togetherness, and they all understand where David wants to go, and he's not an auteur in any stretch of the imagination. Anybody that has a good idea, David's open to listen. He's a big believer in fate, and if there's a mistake that happens on the set, by golly, he'll jump on that, and that's wonderful, so he's always open, and the people that he gets around him, I think that sort of comes through, the first AD and Peter Deming and the actors. David is so easygoing and so relaxed. And he loves what he's doing so much that it just kind of rubs off on everybody, and everyone is just having a blast.
Yeah.
Like David says, he said, when you start the production process, he says it's like being swept away. The production starts, and you're just in the flow.
Right.
And you've got the script and you've got the idea and the you do whatever it takes to be true to the idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been the idea with David.
I would think as an actor it would be incredibly freeing in a way to perform in a David Lynch film. And you interviewed several actors from the Lost Highway set. And what was their general impression of that whole experience of being directed by him?
Well, they love him.
Yeah.
I mean, what's his name? The guy plays Mr. Eddie. Robert Loggia compared him to John Huston, for crying out loud.
Wow.
I mean, compliments like that just don't come out of someone like Loggia.
Right.
And I'll never forget, I was trying to get a rough cut together of the documentary, and I went over and showed it to David. And after watching it, he said, Tobe, you know what you got to do? you got to take all of these sequences and you put each one of them on a 3x5 card, and you take that stack of cards and you throw it up in the air and you let it fall down and you pick them all up and you edit that. I said, okay, Dave. And so and of course I got started on it, but then what it did was it gave me fresh eyes.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't actually edit the whole thing together, but I started down a new way and it made me see things differently. This is the effect this guy has on the people around him.
Wow.
He trusts. He has immense trust in the people that he has around him.
Yes. You mind if we take a phone call?
Not at all.
Let me see. 301 area code. You are on. Go ahead. 301. Okay, 301 is not there.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps 817 will be.
Okay.
817 area code. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hey, guys. This is John with the Dead Air Show.
Hey, John.
I just wanted to, you know, call in real quick and just say, you know, because of David Lynch, a big influence on my life, I've never, ever, ever had to take any acid. And it's a great feeling to know that I can say, you know, I was drug-free in my teenage years because I didn't need it. I was able to have my mind, you know, opened up and get to see other weird things without actually having to take drugs. Thanks to David.
That's a great point.
That is a very good point, John.
Thanks very much.
It's not a backhanded compliment at all. It's actually a big compliment. Lynch is a visionary, and I'm glad that you guys are paying tribute to him. So you guys have a great show.
Thank you so much, John.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye now.
The strange thing is that, you know, some of the best David Lynch movies can be far more haunting than some of the scariest drug experiences out there.
That's true. That's
very
true.
Stick with you for years.
Toby, how do our listeners purchase your film?
Well, I think it's available through Image Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be available through David's website. I mean, you know, it's been out for 10 years now.
Yeah.
I mean, they can get it. I guess directly from me. But Image has the DVD.
Okay.
And you know, that's probably the best way to do it.
Okay. Well, it's a fantastic movie.
It is
a definite must own for any Lynch fan.
Yeah.
It's called Pretty as a Picture, The Art of David Lynch, produced and directed by Toby Keeler. Toby, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Well, you guys don't sound like a bunch of geeks to me.
Well, you haven't seen it.
Thank you so much, Toby.
It's been my pleasure, fellas.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, terrific artist, Toby Keeler.
He's great.
Chris,
wonderful.
I believe our next guest is up and ready for us. So you want to read the intro for Mr. Barinholtz?
Yeah, I'd love to. Everybody, our next guest, Ben Barinholtz, has been an invaluable force in the motion picture business since the late 60s. The inventor of the midnight movie, Mr. Barinholtz was instrumental in the success of countless underground films. In 1977, through his own specialty film distribution company, Libra Films, he nourished Lynch's first feature, Eraserhead, until it entered the stratosphere of cult classic. In the years that followed, Mr. Barinholtz turned to producing, working as executive producer on the Coen Brothers films Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink, and as co-executive producer on Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream.
Wow.
For the first time in his illustrious career, Mr. Barinholtz has gone behind the camera lens and directed his first feature-length film, the documentary Music Inn, which chronicles the formation of the first school of jazz. It is our pleasure to welcome Mr. Ben Barinholtz to the show.
Ben, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
That's quite an illustrious career you've had. And
it's all propaganda.
No, it's not. It's wonderful.
Fantastic. How did it come to you that you could that there was a place for specialty films and midnight movies?
Well, I had I opened the Elgin Theater in 1968, and actually I was quite broke at the time, and I went to the Filmmakers Co-op and convinced them to put in Chelsea Girls on second run for a month, and I didn't have any money to get started, really. So they gave me $48. actually, we ran Chelsea Girls for a month, and then the co-op pulled out, and I started programming it myself. So,
right. So they say that you are the inventor of midnight movies?
I think that has to be clarified a little bit, is that I think there were movies that played at midnight in the 20s. I think the what was innovative in any sense in what I did, it was the first time that a film was actually launched at midnight as
right.
opposed to without it playing anywhere else, and that was El Topo. And it was more of a financial thing. It came about with because of the struggles of running a theater without money, and I was trying to utilize as much of the time as I could. Mm-hmm. Was one element, and the other thing is that they also noticed that particularly in Broadway, off-Broadway shows would open, and in their previews they would do sell-out business, and then as soon as they got their review in the New York Times and it was bad, and it closed the next day. So we were always trying to find an alternative way of reaching a narrow audience economically.
Right.
So out of that, when Alan Douglas came along after he bought El Topo, and he had about $10,000 to open, I just told him, you know, that's not going to work. You're going to get killed on that film. Your reviews are not going to be good. So why don't you let me try opening it at midnight and without advertising?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, within a few weeks, we were selling out a 600-seat theater 7 nights a week. Actually, Friday and Saturday, it went on at 1 in the morning.
Oh, goodness.
And
wow.
It ran for 6 months, and then John Lennon and Yoko Ono were there a few times, and they wound up buying the film, and Alan Klein, who was their accountant, and they opened it on Broadway, I think. Mm. Huge signs, Alan Klein presents, and big advertising campaign. I think it lasted about 3 days. I think they were so embarrassed that they pulled it out of circulation for a long time.
Well, you started your own distribution company, Libra Films, in 75, was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years later, you came across Eraserhead. I would think the release on Eraserhead said 77.
Yeah, well, actually, the person that should really receive credit is because it did play, I think, at the in L.A. at the AFI, and it was a film named of John Quinn that called me, and he said, you've got to see this film. And when they sent me the print, and I was in the middle of the screening, and I just told Fred Baker, who was working for me at that time, just get him on the phone, I want this. And he thought I was out of my bird.
What potential did you see in it?
It's not a question. You know, I'm not an academic. I never had an agenda or anything. So even at my Elgin days, the reason I did get so many different things in there, because if it looked good or if it touched me, or, and I also had a lot of kids working for me that were helpful, and
right.
I would just play anything, since I'm not, I just love film. I wasn't interested in
right.
any, I didn't have an agenda of any kind or an aesthetic that I tried to follow.
Right. Did you have a plan? Did you have a plan to get these movies recognized? Because I understand.
Well, I think one of the elements of distribution, particularly on difficult films, is that you don't really go in with a plan. You let the film in itself will really tell you how to distribute it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question of economics and how you get to a specific audience, particularly a difficult film. And certainly Eraserhead one of my associates at that time, after he saw the film, told me that I was out of my mind and it wouldn't make a dime. Well, it paid my rent for 10 years.
Oh goodness! How long did it run? I think it had like a 2-year run or something.
Well, no, it Eraserhead actually. I didn't have the Elgin at that time. I'd left that, and I opened it at the Cinema Village. I think there was an audience of 25, and first night, second night was 24. I told David it was working, and he looked at me as if I was out of my... I understood. I mean, there was one element to understanding of the scene, Eraserhead, as I told David at the time, he was just about 10 years ahead of his time.
Right.
And that it was going to take a lot of work and patience to do it. So the release was very, very slow. There were even times in the first year where I would not let certain exhibitors play it. You know, I'd get a call from Dallas or Kansas City or whatever, and I would say, no, it's too early. Wait till next year. Word of mouth has to catch up with it. So it wasn't that huge runaway success. It just was much slower in developing.
It was a slow build, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What was the general consensus among those who watched it? What did they think of it?
They didn't know what to make of it, actually. I never told David that half the audience the first 2 days were friends of mine. So it wasn't even, they weren't even all a paying audience. Uh-huh. I couldn't get it reviewed. I couldn't get any critics to see it. I think the only write-up I got on it was in the Village Eye, which doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or it existed for a blink of that eye. I think Gary Indiana interviewed David, and that was its only... slowly it sort of became the film to see, the thing to do.
Yeah, it was definitely buzzed about, I know that. And it was so influential. I think Francis Coppola, I had read, saw it and loved it. And obviously Mel Brooks saw it and was very taken by it. Did you have any interaction with these industry people that were seeing it?
No, not at all, as I try to limit my interaction with industry people to this day.
wise man.
I don't know if it's wisdom or it's lunacy. Maybe a bit of both. But I actually think it had a greater influence in the UK because... it played in a theatrical screen on the Hill for many years, even after, because I had a 10-year agreement on the film, and I actually drew up a contract and flew out to L.A., met with David's lawyers. It was quite a big law firm, and of course they would... doing it pro bono for David, and I put the contract in front of them, and they didn't even look at it. They just told David to sign it. They said, any idiot that's going to want to take this film, let him have it. I did get worldwide rights on it at that time.
But so obviously you had some...
UK was really very important in terms of how many filmmakers it influenced there.
Yeah. You obviously had some communication with Lynch during this time. What kind of...
Well, to the extent that you could communicate with David. since then, David has become much more articulate. David did stay with me. I don't remember the exact time. It may have been a month or two as we were launching or opening the film. And he would go to... his wife Mary was with him, and he would go to the McDonald's, and they'd both be asleep by 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, wow.
So I don't remember having a really serious conversation with him. We did have it, but it wasn't as a lot of since he was a painter, I mean, his natural bent was very tactile. I think that's sort of what attracted me to the film. Certain elements to it that were very, very tactile and painterly, and it just moved me very much in that way. And now, you know, I think I once asked him, because somebody had asked me about, you know, this film reminds me of the German expressionist cinema. And I asked David, had you ever seen any of those films? And he said, no. And I said, well, don't.
I want to talk about some other high points of your career. And another favorite filmmaker of all of ours on the show, filmmakers, are the Coen brothers. And I was wondering, how did your relationship with them begin?
Well, actually, they came to me in trying to get Blood Simple financed originally. And I really couldn't help them. But I saw there was something different. There was some spark there. And there was really very little I could do for them at that time, because they were just trying to raise the money to do it. And they went back to Minneapolis and raised the money on their own. And then by that time, I had formed a partnership with Circle, releasing the Pettis Brothers in Washington. And it was shown in, actually shown by Skouras, who was handling it, and they showed it in Cannes, and I was there, and I didn't even see it because they thought they really had a horror film. and no one really saw it there, and it was quite a time after Cannes that Jim Jacks, who was working for us at that time, he saw it again in Los Angeles, and he called me and said, well, yeah, that's the film, you know, because I was telling him about these guys, of course. So we wound up picking it up for distribution and then produced their next three films, which was Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, and Barton Fink.
Oh, goodness, wow.
Wow.
And now, after all this time, you've decided to go into the director's chair for a documentary feature called Music Ends.
Pure accident. I never wanted to be a director. Music Inn was a place that existed, it existed actually until the late 70s, but in the from 1950 to 1960, it was owned by Stephanie and Phil Barber, and they opened it as an inn for music, and they took the barns of an estate, Wheatley, which is quite a grand estate, and they started having round table discussions about jazz and folk music. Actually, the first appearance at Music Inn was actually by Woody Guthrie, which we do have a recording of that, of Woody Guthrie with Alan Lomax, who brought him there. And then they started having these round tables and actually tracing jazz, and jazz studies was not very popular at that time. Actually, there weren't any. And there was a fellow named Marshall Stearns, who was a Chaucer scholar, but also a jazz aficionado. We started these round tables, and they just would have these various people come up there and just discuss the roots of jazz and folk. There wasn't that kind of separation at that time between jazz and folk and blues and all of that.
Right.
And out of that round table discussions also grew, they decided to start create a performance space, which they did, which actually was almost at the same time as the Newport Jazz Festival started. And George Ween was actually at Music Inn and was influenced very much in what he did at Newport. And they actually had everybody there, from Billie Holiday to Louis Armstrong. And so.
And this is all documented in the film?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it's very popular in a sense. And then out of that, because the MJQ, the Modern Jazz Quartet, with John Lewis was up there, they were sort of the group in residence, they decided to start the first school of jazz.
Hmm.
And the faculty included, besides the MJQ, was also Max Roach and Dizzy Gillespie and Gunther Schuller, who really created called the Third Stream. And that's quite an illustrious faculty. And that lasted for 3 years. So that was to the end of 1960. And I had met, Stephanie in the early 70s and kept hearing about this place. And then one day, I was with her when we got the news that John Lewis had died, and I just said, I better do something because they're all dying.
Right.
So that's sort of how I got involved in making this documentary.
Well, I know that it just premiered at Tribeca.
Yeah.
Did it? And how can our listeners see your film?
Well, right now, I'm actually in the process of doing a little re-edit on it, shortening it a bit, and it's going to go into the Munich Film Festival at the end of June.
Oh, goodness.
And hopefully I will get either sales agents or a distributor to take it off my hands, because I really... don't want to handle it myself in the sales, and so that will be probably won't be available until later this year.
Okay. Well, Mr. Barinholtz, you've made an invaluable contribution to cinema, and you've championed a lot of fantastic artists along the way. And as movie fans, we can't thank you enough.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much for calling into our
welcome
show.
Welcome. Keep up geekdom.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Ben Barinholtz. We turn now to an examination of one of the most important elements in any Lynch film, and that is sound. Lynch is known as one of the most expressive cinematic sound artists in the history of the medium, and when the sound work is coupled with his indelible imagery, the result often has the power to transport you like no other films. Tonight, we discuss Lynch's particular brilliance with sound with two of the finest and most prolific sound technicians in the industry. Douglas Murray has nearly 60 film credits to his name, performing sound duties on films like Species, Contact, The English Patient, and Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, for which his team won the 2006 Golden Reel Award. His latest work can be heard in the forthcoming release of We Own the Night, starring Robert Duvall, Joaquin Phoenix, and Mark Wahlberg. In 1992, Murray served as the supervising sound editor on David Lynch's film Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Mark Jan Vordakevich served as an assistant sound editor on that same film. Vordakevich's vast film credits include work on Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, Wag the Dog, Armageddon, Deja Vu, and Walk the Line. He's won two Golden Reel Awards, one for his work in Walk the Line, and another as music editor of The Mothman Prophecies. It is a great pleasure to welcome these distinguished craftsmen to our show. Douglas and Mark, let me see if I can get you up here on the switchboard. Douglas and Mark, are you guys there?
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, great. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm especially pleased to have you both on the show with us tonight because, personally, I think that Fire Walk With Me is one of the most astounding examples of sound in film. And Douglas, I know you worked as a supervising sound editor on that film, and Mark as an assistant sound editor.
Mm-hmm.
What do those positions entail exactly?
Well, in the case of the supervising sound editor, it's a... you're responsible to coordinate all the sound for the film, except for the music, really.
Right.
It's the supervisor's job to hire the crew and make sure the tracks are delivered to the mix in a way that the director wants. So, for any film, that's the case.
Right.
There's, a lot of work that is typically done by the supervising sound editor that could also be described as sound design or whatever on some films, you know, depending on the nature of the film. The assistant, Mark, in this case, worked very closely with me on the sound of the film, and I did a lot of work designing sounds that were in the film. David, you know, is the sound designer of record and did have a huge impact on the track, as I'm sure he has on all of his films.
Yeah, yeah. How would you, Mark, how would you rate Lynch in terms of a filmmaker who understands and is kind of innovative with the use of sound in his movies?
Well, you know, at the time, it was very much at the beginning of my career, so I didn't really know really how much this all worked. I mean, it was literally the third film I worked on,
right,
with Doug, and I had just started out. I came out of theater sound, so it was just this crazy thing. And one thing I have to say is having it being at the beginning of my career, it's kind of taught me you can be extremely free about manipulating sound. And from that point on, you know, several years later, I started doing music editing, and it's kind of what I'm known as now. But at the time, I would say he gave us tremendous permission to, you know, to excuse the cliche, but think out the box. And almost every sound in that film was, you know, created from an organic, actual element. I mean, one of the things that I was involved with specifically was going out in the field and recording things and, you know, beating up boxcars and breaking glass and, you know, trying to create all the sort of specific elements. Me and a couple other people, a guy named Phil Benson and Steve Kearney, you know, were constantly running around recording stuff. And, you know, we'd make these libraries and hand them over to Doug and Donnie Blank, and, you know, they would do the editorial and manipulate and do all this sort of crazy stuff to it. And then, of course, David, then there would be the whole David layer, which would be move this around and pitch it down 10 octaves and all that kind of crazy stuff. So it was all very, there was just a tremendous permission to present something that, you know, even though it was organic, that had no relationship to the thing that you thought it was going to be. And in terms of other directors, some directors are very laissez-faire, you know. They kind of just want you to show up and make the film sound good. And other directors, you know, want to detail everything. My memory is that David was more hands-on than most. Mm-hmm. There's definitely more hands-on than most. And, of course, as his career has progressed, to, you know, that meant really doing it all himself.
was he someone that, I mean, you've spoken to this, he's someone that knew exactly what he wanted, but he still allowed you room to create? I'm wondering what the creative process was like when you were working with him. Was he very communicative about what exactly he wanted?
Well, let me answer that one. It's I would say that David, I believe that David does not know what he wants until he is actually working on it,
right,
at least in terms of the sound. In other words, he knew the kinds of elements that he would like to hear in the movie and the kinds of moods he wanted to create. But when we got to the final mix and he was there, in fact, he's definitely the most hands-on director in terms of sound that I've ever worked with. Mm. Because he wants to make as much of the sound himself as possible. He was the music mixer on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. And he, you know, he likes to improvise. I think he's probably more like an abstract painter in terms of the way he works with sound, or a painter, I should say. He looks at the canvas of the film and tries to think, as we're mixing it, what does it want now at this point? And then he will give direction, which is often completely unexpected. You know, in spite of the fact that we've talked about the scene before and we've worked on it, and I would have asked him questions and he would give guidance, and then we would get to the mix and he would, you know, you could say change his mind, or he would get a new idea. He would come up with something completely different and we would make it up on the spot. I have to say that I worked with him twice. I worked with him on the pilot as well.
Oh,
and on the pilot for Twin Peaks, we didn't have that luxury. We had to, he told me what he wanted, and I prepared it, and we mixed it in with very little fuss. You know, there were a few things we worked out in the mix, but we didn't have time to do a lot of sound design work during the mix.
Mm-hmm.
But on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, it was a much larger budget. We had several weeks instead of the 1 week we had on the pilot to mix it. So we spent a lot of time in the mix. I had this newfangled technique of the sampler, the Emulator 3 it was, which is a, you know, a MIDI-controlled sampler, which we set up in the mix with a lot of the sounds we knew he wanted to be in the film that we had cut into the film. And then we performed things live directly into the track, you know, as he came up with these ideas.
Mm. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of natural kind of environmental sounds in his films. I'm thinking, too, about the indoor scenes, of course. There seems to be a low kind of rumbling hum that permeates a lot of those scenes. How are his sounds generally created?
Well, everything kind of starts from an organic place. And, you know, working up at Saul's Ants, there was definitely a technique of, you know, not going to a library, for example. We went out and did a tremendous amount of recording. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time, as Doug was saying, that, you know, samplers were just coming online and digital techniques were just coming online for editorial. And so we would just create these libraries. You know, we were talking about earlier. Actually, I'm sitting in Doug's backyard. It's kind of funny. We're having this conversation. We were going to tell you this later, I guess. But we were discussing this for about an hour beforehand. It's like, oh, what are we going to talk about? But we had made these tremendous libraries of sound. And so I would go out and beat up a boxcar, you know, and we would record it. And there's actually a story about Steve Kearney and I breaking into the Alameda train yard in the middle of the night and finding a boxcar and, you know, just literally kicking the shit out of it and finding as many little things to, you know, manipulate and things. So we'd go back, we would take our DATs, we would record them into the computer, and then we would make libraries of individual sounds and then hand them off to the editors, in which case they would just start manipulating them. You know, and, of course, the standard sound design manipulation is you pitch everything down. You know, put it down a couple octaves, and it gets very mysterious. And, you know, one of David's and actually a lot of people who went through Saul's Ants at the time, there's these train squeals that we had. And you pitch those way down, and you get this incredible metallic, organic tonalities that, you know, are just Lynchian by their inherent nature.
Right.
So I don't think there's really not too much stuff that was basically synthetic that came from a synthesizer and or anything like that. I mean, they all started as sort of organic sounds. Even his manipulation of music was very organic. He would take recordings and like Penderecki and pitch it way down, and you get these tones that you just simply couldn't synthesize. So even though nothing felt quote-unquote real, it all came, most of it came from real stuff. And then there's the whole world of Angelo Badalamenti, and his stuff is very synthetic, and I think that's how it differentiates itself sonically from in the palette, is that the world is organic and the emotional context of the music is actually highly synthetic.
Right. Badalamenti's score always contributes so much to his films, the mood of his films. Did you put that score in, or did you work with the score at all in your duties as a sound designer on the film?
In the case of Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, it was Lori Eschler who was the music editor and had been the music editor on the Twin Peaks series, the TV series. And she had this cool machine that was pretty advanced at the time, an SSL screen sound it was called, which is a digital audio workstation that had a hard disk that could play back maybe 8 tracks at a time. And it had a light pen. It was like, you know, Pro Tools or something now, but only at the time, this was one of the early machines. So she could take the sound that had been written for the film and quickly take them from a list and place them anywhere in the scene, in any scene. And he would frequently, during the mix, ask for, you know, again, unexpected music to appear in places that it wasn't envisioned originally. And often, you know, played at half speed or backwards or overlaying several cues at once. And she was able to do that with this machine fairly quickly. It would have been much, much more time-consuming to do it on magnetic film, which was the dominant technology at the time.
Right. His sound seems to, maybe it's all those effects that you spoke of, but more than any other director, his sound seems to kind of seep into your subconscious in a way. And I know that he likes the sound level to be loud. Is that correct? Or?
Well, I have to tell you a story about that. You know, this film was mixed on for Dolby Stereo, which is a, you know, an optical analog format. Surround sound format, which was, you know, the only one available really at the time. So it has a limit, a loudness limit, which was considered, you know, plenty loud, but it's much quieter than what you can do with a modern digital track. It's probably 10 or 15 dB quieter. So he wanted the scene in the roadhouse back room, the music, to be as loud as possible.
Right.
And you know, I don't think he is into loud for its own sake. There's a lot of dynamics in the film. There are quiet scenes, lots of them. But when he wants it loud, he wants it loud. And that music is pretty driving. And he wanted it to be as loud as possible. And, you know, there's a dialogue scene in the middle of that room in the during the music. And the mixer, David Parker, who is an unsung genius of film sound, you know, turned to David and said, you know, as he kept saying, no, no, louder, louder. Play, no, no, it's still not loud enough. Turn it up as loud as it can possibly go. And then let's hear that. And then he did, and he said, okay, that's how loud I want it. And David said, well, you know, there's no way we're going to understand the dialogue then. You know, this is a dialogue scene. We have to be able to hear the dialogue. Shall I just pull it down under the dialogue? No, leave it as loud as it goes. So they ended up, as you know, subtitling the scene so that you could hear what, you know, understand what they were saying, even though you can't really hear it very well.
Or understand it, actually.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, but...
Well, that's it's a memorable scene in the movie. There's lots of movies where, you know, there's a scene in a bar and there's background music, but that scene, if you really feel like you're in that bar and it's so loud and smoky and, you know...
It's an amazing scene. Just from a personal standpoint, I remember the first time I went to see Firewalk with Me in the theater, and it was set up really well. The sound was, the acoustics were incredible in the theater.
Great.
I was standing out in the hallway waiting to get in and for the previous show to end, and the door cracked open somewhat, and I just heard the climax of the film, just Laura's screams and the humming, and it's just so dynamic. And I felt it in my heart. I said, what am I about to walk into here? But the sound was just so incredible in that film. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Great work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Well, and good luck with the rest of your show.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
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 Bye-bye. Great guests. Okay.
Oh, yeah, so far it's been incredible.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And it, honestly, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the sound just blew me away, literally.
I find it amazing that what I like is, though, that he is, what we've heard from all these people so far, is that he's very hands into the whole filmmaking process. He really loves the process of making the movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, he's an artist in the truest sense of the word. He knows that at the end of the day, this is going to be a David Lynch movie, and
right.
we're going to remember it as his artwork, even though there's other artists, you know, it's a collaborative effort, but people think of David Lynch movies as, you know, a real piece of art, and they are.
Yes.
And so it makes sense that he would be this hands-on.
No, it's great, and he also that he values everyone's opinion. If you bring a good idea to the table, he's going to go with it.
Absolutely.
Right.
Guys, our next guest is here.
Okay.
So Martha Nockamson is here. She's a highly prolific film writer, and a frequent contributor to Film Quarterly, where her examination of Inland Empire will appear this summer, and Cineast Magazine, where she is also an associate editor. She's the author of several books, including The Passion of David Lynch, Wild at Heart in Hollywood, for which she spent many hours with Lynch in the midst of shooting Lost Highway. And her new book is called Dying to Belong, Gangster Movies in Hollywood and Hong Kong. She is currently working on two new books, one covering the cultural sensation that is The Sopranos, and another on David Lynch's film work from the past 10 years. We are very pleased to welcome to the show Martha P. Nockamson. Martha,
hi.
You there?
I sure am.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome. How's the show going?
It's going very well. We've had some fantastic guests and fantastic conversation on David Lynch, and we're just geeking out over here.
Geeking out.
Yeah.
Well, I was listening to the last interview, just the last couple of minutes of the interview about the sound.
Mm-hmm.
That was really that was a lot of fun to hear.
Yeah, sound is so important in a Lynch film. So
extremely important. I think he's one guy who really understands that sound is as dynamic, and that's a word you've been using,
mm-hmm.
An element as visual. Sound isn't supposed to just support the visual. It collaborates with the visual.
Absolutely.
So they're both on an equal level.
Right.
And it was a lot of fun to hear.
Yeah, for us too. Now, you obviously spent a lot of time with Lynch when you were preparing for your book.
I did. I was extremely fortunate, and it was really one of the high points of my life.
I know that you had to have gone in with some kind of preconceived notions of what he would be like.
I absolutely did.
What surprised you the most about him?
The thing, isn't that funny? He asked me the same question. on the first visit, the first contact I had with David Lynch was a half an hour phone call, and that was in '92, I think. And I was not surprised by that because it was extremely intense.
Mm.
He spoke to me in Gordon Cole's voice. And you'd think, it would be so easy to write that off as, oh, this is just an interesting shtick, you know. And,
right.
I can't take this man seriously because he's a showman like Alfred Hitchcock, you know, with,
mm-hmm.
with all the little numbers that he pulled. But the fact of the matter was that I think he's very shy, actually. I think that's what that was about, and it's very hard for him to talk to people that he doesn't know, and it's, of course, as everybody knows, extremely difficult for him to talk about his work. And I think
right.
he just used the Cole voice as a prop. But the conversation was so intense that I was just breathless when I put the phone down.
I can imagine.
Really. And this image just popped into my mind. I felt as if I'd been holding fire in the palm of my hand.
Mm.
Make what you will of that.
Okay.
I don't know what that means either, but that was the sensation that I had. I think the thing that surprised me when I met him was... Well, so many things, really. One thing that was really very interesting, and this I had not... I spent a week with him in his studio.
Mm-hmm.
He was between films, and he gave me hours and hours every single day.
Wow.
It was astonishing to me.
Wow.
It was amazing. And what I had decided to do, because I knew that he didn't like talking directly... was I came prepared with art books of his favorite artists, and I came prepared with movies of his favorite directors, and we talked about those things. And it was easier for him to talk about that. But I think what surprised me most, and of course this is in my book, is I was a university professor for 26 years, and a critic and a scholar. And there's a certain habit of mind that you get into.
Mm-hmm.
And that habit of mind is that you acquire information.
Right.
And you acquire information by going after it with a certain kind of tenacity and perseverance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't stop. And you keep going until you get it.
Right.
And what I realized when I was talking to David was that that wasn't going to work at all. I felt like I was bumping into an invisible wall. And it was clear that if I kept going forward, I would get nothing.
Right.
What I had to do was let go of every expectation that I had.
Yeah, yeah.
And just let it happen to me. And that was very hard for me, but it was very, very exciting.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I had learned from him until, you know, months afterward. I had tapes. I thought about it. And I realized that he was talking to me all along, just not in the way that I had expected.
Right.
He told me everything. But he didn't, you know how we ask for an answer in this? Like, tell me how you feel about this, you know, reporters that stick a microphone in somebody's face when they're,
yes.
The child is dead in their arms. How do you feel about this? I mean, it's just sort of a strange American grossness. But I realized that in letting go, things sort of came in through my nervous system. This sounds bizarre, but in fact, that is true.
Well, you know, it actually doesn't sound bizarre. What you're describing about, you know, letting go and sort of letting him, you know, do the work on his own, it sounds like a David Lynch film. It's kind of the same way
yes,
you have to go
yeah.
into a David Lynch film.
That's what I was going to say, too.
Who am I talking to? There are two voices here.
There are three of them.
The three of them.
Oh, sorry, okay.
I'm Jamie.
I'm Jerry.
Right, Jamie, yeah, and Jerry.
And
Jerry,
I'm
are you the one who said it's like watching a David Lynch
film? No, that was Chris.
Chris, hi, Chris. Yeah, that's how I learned how to watch a David Lynch film.
Huh, that's very
Because if you read a lot of the criticism, see, my book came out in 97. Take a look at the criticism before then. It's people imposing old structures
mm-hmm.
on his film. No way. You know, oh, he doesn't have a three-act script. Mm. Like, yeah, okay, right. He doesn't have a three-act script. And, you know, he's what is he doing with genre? You know, all this kind of thing that people are saying, that he's weird, that he's crazy, that he's miserable, that he's mean, that he
loves
violence.
None of these things.
You do have to let go to watch a David Lynch film. And it seems to me that, you know, it's wonderful to hear you say that, Chris, because it seems to me that more and more, and I'm sure it's a generational thing as well as the turn in criticism that has taken place, a little self-serving of me, but, you know, since my book.
Well, I read your book before Mulholland Drive came out.
Okay.
I had actually read it like 2 weeks before it came out here. And that helped me out a lot.
Really?
Yes.
Those are the nicest words I ever hear.
No, your book is really wonderful, because a couple books came out at the time, but yours was by far like the most interesting, the most in-depth about him and his films up to that point.
Well, thank you.
And you've written so extensively about Lynch's films, and I wanted to know your thoughts on a few things.
Sure, go.
Would you say that David is a good storyteller?
Very good storyteller. Brilliant. But keeping in mind, if you think you're going to get a story like Once Upon a Time There Was a Princess Named
mm-hmm.
Cinderella, you can go home. you have to let him tell his story the way he tells it.
Right.
And he's always telling you, while he's telling the story, let go. Let this happen to you.
Absolutely.
And the loud sounds that you were talking about.
Right.
And a lot of the visual techniques, it's about, you know, stop trying to control this.
Yeah.
Love it. Get into it. Mm-hmm. Let it happen. Enjoy it. But not in a mindless way. It is going somewhere. It has a direction. It has a shape. It has a beautiful form. And it is a great story.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to let him tell it the way he tells it. He's an artist. He's a storyteller.
Right.
It's beautiful.
For me, it feels like people that seem so preoccupied with discussing the meaning in his films are missing out on something somehow.
Is a meaning, but tell me a little bit more about that. What do you mean by preoccupied with meaning?
Well, when I see his films, I see them as kind of Rorschach inkblot test. How does this make you feel? What do you see in this?
Right.
And this is part of the reason why I completely understand why he himself doesn't discuss meaning, because that's the creator telling you where he was coming from, and that's the word of God, and you know that kind of belittles your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Some interesting things you're saying.
But do you think that his films are meant to be puzzles? Are puzzles waiting to be solved, or are people missing out on something if they do that?
They're missing out on something if they do that. And this may sound strange. At the same time, they absolutely have a meaning.
Right.
But the puzzle mentality is a controlling mentality.
Mm-hmm.
The Sherlock Holmes mentality. Notice that Agent Cooper, he's a brilliant detective, but he's not a Sherlock Holmes type detective at all.
Mm-hmm.
He has to let go and let the dreams come to him.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there is a meaning, but not if you insist on reaching out, grabbing it, because the truth of the matter is that, right, and we all know this, we know it intuitively. Excuse me a second. Let me take a little water. Rationality understands nothing but what it already knows.
Mm-hmm.
It's intuition, sense, sensuality, instinct, and something, a higher form of spirituality that is capable of new thought.
Right.
And new consciousness. That's a hard one for people who are doggedly rational because, I mean, like I've been accused of being New Age, which really translates into fluffy-headed. Anything but. I'm not that sort of person at all. I'm not that sort of thinker at all. But what I've learned to do is to have a new experience and to work with creators on their terms. So at the same time, if you make the Lynch movie into a puzzle, you miss the whole movie because
right.
It's a sensory experience. But sense is intelligence of a very high order. Eventually, it has to collaborate. Does this mean anything to you, what I'm saying?
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah,
it makes perfect sense. What I take from it is you kind of sit through the movie and experience that, you know, that sensory experience, and then what I do after that is I like to think about his movies afterwards. If I want to, you know, work on the puzzle part of it, if I want to try and understand something about it, I think about it afterwards. But if I let my mind get caught up while I'm watching one of his movies, it's a waste of time, you know? It's just very confusing.
Yeah, I have to agree with Chris there. It's not like you're watching one of these films that have those trick endings or anything and you have to go... It's like, no, these are real pieces of art, and they're meant to... You think about them long after you leave the theater or watching them.
Yeah, I think that's a very fruitful way of doing it. And I think that the way that, you know, I've learned to read the movies from talking to David, whom I like very much, I find him to be not weird, but kind and generous. And he's a pleasure to be with. He really is a pleasure to be with. He's got an open heart. He's got an intuitive mind. He's full of life, and he's full of enjoyment,
mm-hmm.
you know, joy. The world is a joyous place for him, which, of course, one of the great misconceptions is that he's dark and that these films are about how bad life is. But, you know, one image that I like to use when I talk to students or friends or, you know, people who would just, you know, are wondering how I think about it or what I feel is, you know, in the fairy tale, The treasure is guarded by the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
The darkness in life is the dragon. That's in the way of everything that's joyous and wonderful about life. And Lynch's stories are about us encountering that darkness so that we can get past it to what's great about being a human being.
Absolutely. And there is a redemption at the closing of most of his films.
Yes.
What kind of themes, we spoke about this earlier with Toby.
Yes, so yes.
You know, he's had such kind of an idyllic upbringing. Where does the darkness come from?
Who had such an idyllic upbringing?
David, yeah. Yes.
Okay, the darkness comes from, look around you. Do you think that America is a happy place?
Thinking that. No, I get that. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
Do you see what I'm saying? He is not afraid to look.
Right.
And he believes that beyond all the junk that we're saddled with and the crazy things that we're taught to want that are totally useless, you can get beyond that, but you can't do it by reasoning it. You have to, as we've been saying all along, let go, which is very hard to do, and get to that spiritual place in you that sees beyond the false way. Now, there are true things around us, too, but there are a lot of false ways that society is organized,
mm-hmm.
We're taught lies, really. And one of the lies, well, never mind, I don't want to get too caught up, but if you can get beyond that, and I think that's one of the motivations of his David Lynch Foundation, where he's trying to help kids learn how to meditate.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
It's a very beautiful thing that he's doing.
Oh, it is.
I think so too.
I'd like to ask a question. Since you are, do you think, just talking about what we've talked about, where the dark things come from, do you think that Inland Empire, which I've only seen once, and I actually feel guilty even talking about it after one viewing, but I just want to ask you, because you know so much about him, his style and everything, do you think, is Inland Empire David Lynch's reflection of post-9/11 America?
No.
Okay, I just thought
that. Excuse me. Forgive me for saying it that way. I don't think so.
Okay.
But if you think so, then you ought to, you're absolutely right. I've seen it 3 times. And the DVD is coming out July 21st, and, I'm first online. and I expect to just watch it and watch it and watch it. Because it's just I think it's his greatest work to date. But what I think it's about is I think it's about everything I've been talking about now. He uses the vehicle of a woman artist,
right,
dealing with Hollywood,
right,
as a way of talking about how, if you get into yourself far enough, you can transcend the false things around you and the problems around you.
Mm.
And what's real, I mean, Fellini, are you familiar with the films of Federico Fellini?
Yes.
He says the same thing. But what he says is you have to lose the world in order to do it. Remember that in Inland Empire, she turns in a successful performance that her director thinks is going to win her awards, but the most important thing that happens to her is an internal adventure that
right.
took place while this was happening. And I think that that's what that's about.
No, okay, no, I just figured I'd ask. I just wanted to ask it.
That is the beauty of Lynch.
Absolutely.
Whatever you see in it, that's what it is for you.
Well, I'm you know, sort of, I think that's one stage of enjoying art. Whatever it is for you, that's what it is for you. But I do believe that if you stay at that level, you never get beyond your own boundaries.
Right.
And that eventually you have to question whether you are limiting, and I'm not just talking about Lynch now, any work of art, whether you are limiting it to your own experience and whether the work of art can help you if you, you know, listen to it carefully enough and question some of your conclusions and talk to people that you trust who are also, you know, thinking about it. I think it's very important to get beyond your boundaries or you don't, you know, develop as a person.
Right.
Absolutely.
To let go, what we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, it's all about letting go.
I find it, you know, it's a challenge, a big challenge for me, but it's one that I've grown to love.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about some of the recurring themes, or at least one of the recurring themes in Lynch's films.
Sure.
And that's his depiction of the abused woman.
Yeah.
I know this is some point of controversy in his films, but what are your thoughts on how he depicts women in his films?
Right. Well, one of the funniest moments, you know, during my first series of interviews with him that I was just telling you about,
mm-hmm.
was I said to him, are you a feminist? I thought his teeth would fall on the floor. Nobody has ever asked him that question in his life. And his answer to me was, well, Martha, there's always room for improvement. I think that he has an uncanny ability. People have asked me if he's gay. And the reason that they have, I think, I mean, I don't know why the hell they would. I mean, he's definitely not gay. But I think that the thing that's many things that are extraordinary about him, but one of the things that's extraordinary about him is his uncanny empathy for female experience.
Right.
His heroines are amazingly observed. I mean, in Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me that you were just talking about, is very difficult, or was at one point, for men to watch because they were being forced to put themselves in the place of a female victim of abuse,
yes.
The last thing an American man wants to do.
Yeah, the Fire Walk with Me is a highly emotional experience for me when I watch it.
I believe it.
Yeah, and what's your take on the one of his most infamous scenes, which is from Wild at Heart, the Bobby Peru Lula motel room scene?
Right.
Do you think that's a scene about female empowerment? I read an interview with Laura Dern where she believed that it was.
Well, why did she think it was a scene about female empowerment?
I believe the point, her point was ultimately that she there's no delicate way to put this, that she got off on the experience with Bobby Peru.
That's interesting.
And so that was not it wasn't conducive with her being victimized.
Well, I think she's a marvelous actress,
right.
And I think she's a very bright woman. You know, I always like listening to her talk. I wouldn't exactly say that's correct. if that's what motivated her to be able to do the scene without feeling humiliated, then fine, that's not a problem. But it seems to me that Lula is living in a world that is very abusive to women, and that Sailor, in his own way, participates in that. And that this is a movie that sees through the abuse but doesn't join it. The film is not abusive to women. It's about a society that is abusive to women.
Right.
And I think that's a feminist point of view.
Right.
I think that it's simplistic to only want to show women who are strong and in charge, because that's not real.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think that showing what Lula had to put up with and how she had to deal with, you know, things happening to her, is, and sympathizing with her, not making it look like fun. You remember in James Bond when he rapes Pussy Galore, but it's put in the movie, it looks like a wonderful love scene?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I call anti-feminist.
Right.
That is, you know, sort of making rape look like fun. This didn't look like fun at all. And so the notion of a man who can do anything he wants to you because he's bigger and stronger, he, I mean, he looked about as bad as anybody can look, I think that's a feminist point of view.
Right.
But she was not empowered. As I see it, Lula was in a very bad place in that movie, and we were to understand that she was in a bad place in that movie, and we were to understand it wasn't because there was something wrong with her, but something wrong with him.
Absolutely.
Right.
It always seemed like a kind of curious take on it, and I re-rented the Wild at Heart DVD the other week, and it's there in the extra features where they're speaking to the female empowerment theory.
Hmm.
I just wanted your take on it. But I can't let you get away without asking you about The Sopranos. we're doing a show next week dedicated to The Sopranos. Before the series finale. And,
yeah.
And you're working on a book. What kind of take do you have on The Sopranos?
Well. The show isn't over yet. I don't have any take. The story has not been completed. For my book, Dying to Belong, Gangster Movies in Hollywood and Hong Kong, that you very kindly mentioned up front, it's about the history of gangster movies in Hollywood and Hong Kong, but I did interview David Chase extensively, which was another very wonderful experience. I really like David Chase.
Oh, I bet. I
had great time talking to him. He's a really bright, wonderful man. The last chapter in the book and the afterword in the book are very much about The Sopranos. So I can't give you my take on the entire show because I haven't seen it yet.
Right.
But if you want to ask me a more limited question, I love talking about The Sopranos. It's, you know,
who doesn't?
You know, David Chase loves David Lynch.
I read that. Yeah.
I would understand that. I can understand that.
And like David Lynch, he has a real knack for music.
Yes, he does.
Musicality of what he does.
And look at the sound in The Sopranos.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's been very, very much inspired by David Lynch. And he has, of course, his own blazing talent. I mean, there's a great storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. Well, we can't wait. When that book comes out, you have to come back on our show.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I'll be writing a book about The Sopranos, which is another book. Well, thank you. I'd love to. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Martha.
You very much, Martha.
Martha
My
Knox.
Pleasure. Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Martha Knockemson. The book is called The Passion of David Lynch, Wild at Heart in Hollywood, and check out her new book, Dying to Belong, Gangsters in Hollywood and Hong Kong. You can buy them at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. The links are on our blogs. Jerry, I think our final guest for the evening is up and ready to go.
Okay, our final guest is Sean Levy. We are thrilled tonight to share the last segment of our show with one of the most renowned and respected film critics in the country. He is not only author of such best-selling books as King of Comedy, The Life and Art of Jerry Lewis, and Rat Pack Confidential, but he's also the prolific film critic for The Oregonian. Mr. Levy wrote of David Lynch's last film, Inland Empire, "It's filled with moments of breathtaking invention. Lynch is so singular a talent and so pure a filmmaker that he almost can't help but produce moments that rattle your preconceptions of what a movie can be." We're pleased to have Mr. Levy on the show tonight to guide us through a critical roundtable discussion of Lynch's resume of films.
Mr. Levy, are you there?
I am.
Oh,
thanks
great.
So
welcome,
much.
Sean.
Hi. Hey, thanks for the introduction and the invite.
Anytime. Okay, I'm going to get this started right now. Where would you rank David Lynch? Would you rank him as one of our greatest filmmakers?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't always see things like in a hierarchy or a ladder, but, you know, he is certainly a continent unto himself, and there are so few artists in any medium, but especially a medium that is so that consumes financial resources as much as filmmaking does.
Right.
So few people who can attain that status that, you know, I suppose by any measure he is one of the greats.
Absolutely. He's definitely one of our most unique artists. You know, his stamp is on every film that he does. You've never seen a David Lynch film before.
That's true.
And he changes from film to film and sometimes from scene to scene. You know, there are people who, you know, have a phase and then they go into another phase. This guy has a phase that lasts 2-3 scenes.
That's very true. Okay, well, I have to ask you, Sean, just because I'm dying to know, what is your personal favorite film from David Lynch?
Well, you know, it's probably no one else's favorite Lynch movie, and it's The Straight Story.
I knew you were going to say that.
There you go.
I knew it. I just knew it. Okay, why?
Well, you know, it's not that it doesn't have the Lynch stuff in it, and then that makes it better for me somehow. It's just that it's perfect. It's like an egg. You know, it's simple. It's heartfelt. It's completely emotionally direct. And it just shows that, you know, he's not making these other movies because he doesn't have the tools to do work that, you know, say John Ford could have done or Abbas Kiarostami. He's doing it because that's what he wants to do. And if he changes his mind and wants to do something else, he can merely make, you know, one of the great melodramas ever made in Hollywood. I was on a plane flying from London to San Francisco, which is about a 12-hour flight. And on this particular airline, they had a video screen in the seat back in front of you. And it had like 20 channels. And they were recycling movies on about half of those channels. And I had a big pile of reading. I wasn't going to watch a movie, but The Straight Story was on. And I just kept it on that channel. And every now and then I'd look up from my meal or what I was reading, and there would be a scene from The Straight Story, and I would just get absorbed in it again. And, you know, there's nothing in that movie that I could say, oh, if only he had tweaked it. Or, you know, there are things that leave me scratching my head in a lot of Lynch movies, nothing in that movie.
Right.
Wow.
You know, and he has claimed that out of all of his films, that is his experimental film.
Yeah.
But I read an interview with him where he was discussing The Straight Story and the final reunion scene. And the interviewer said that he got very emotional talking about it. And I think that's something that people forget about David Lynch. They probably think he's very cerebral but I think he's very clearly an emotional filmmaker, and The Straight Story is a prime example of that.
Yeah, and he's, as I say, the grammar of the film, the basic communicative tools are so simple. And you look, turn on cable TV, the Lifetime channel, the Hallmark Hall of Fame channel, if there is such a thing, and watch people try and make movies like this.
Right.
And they are so bad.
Oh, yeah.
And here's a guy who is capable of, you know, twisting your mind into a knot, and he just takes this thing. It's about as complex as a toothpick, and it's perfect.
Yeah. And
we've had several of our guests tonight talk about, you know, him personally, what a joyous guy he is. And we get, as fans, you know, I think a lot of people get caught up thinking of him as, you know, like Jamie said, cerebral and, you know, just difficult and dark. But The Straight Story is, I think, an example of exactly that, how he is really just a joyous person. Elephant Man, too.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. When I finally saw that, I guess, after college, I watched it with my mom on TV, and it's such a different film from everything I had seen up until that point, because I had not seen that originally, and it's such a heartfelt movie.
Very uplifting.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
And for me, Wild at Heart works on, well, we're going to discuss all these movies, but just very quickly, Wild at Heart for me works because the strength of the love in that relationship, that central relationship, is so powerful. I think Sailor and Lula are one of the great screen couples of modern times. because their love and respect for one another is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of positive, powerful things in Lynch's films that people tend to overlook because of the darkness that's portrayed as well.
Well, you think of Laura Dern's final speech in Blue Velvet, and she's talking about the Robins and, you know, the perfect world that they're going to inherit.
Yes.
And the Kyle MacLachlan character.
Right.
And, you know, there's a temptation to laugh at that. But I think there's a wide streak in Lynch that actually means what she is saying.
He believes that, yeah.
But, you know, he also sleeps, and in his sleep, things happen as they do in all of our sleeps. And he has the ability to conjure those in a waking state that very few of us have.
True.
Thank God.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start. Why don't we go through Lynch's resume, and let's all talk about our thoughts on each of these films. And we've already talked about The Straight Story, so we're going to leave that out. But I had a feeling, Sean, you were going to say that. I really did. I'm not just saying that for dramatic effect. I really did. Let's start with Eraserhead.
Yeah, I'm going to have to watch this conversation from the sidelines because I'm pretty sure the last time I saw Eraserhead was at a midnight showing in West Philadelphia in the
early 80s. You probably saw it with my brother.
I'm reckoning I saw it with your brother, and I'm just going to say that at least from my seat, there might have been more of one than one of your brother in the theater, if you follow my drift. So my impression of it was like, oh, my God, but it's such a remote impression that I can't quite ascribe anything more than that to it.
Okay.
Well,
guys?
It's definitely tailored. It's definitely cult classic material. If ever there was a movie produced that would fit that mold, it's Eraserhead. I've actually seen the short films of David Lynch as well, and I'm taken by, from the very beginning, his command of sound was incredible, and there's a kind of that low rumbling hum that I've been talking about is present in every shot of Eraserhead, and it unnerves you. And I think that Lynch wanted the film to unnerve you. He was in a bad place in his life, and I think it was a reflection of how miserable he was. I think it was in Philadelphia.
Yeah, he calls the film a Philadelphia of the mind in an interview.
Yeah, and it's powerful stuff. I don't understand all of it, but then again, I've given up that notion. I don't need to absolutely understand everything when I see a Lynch film. But it's it influenced it got Mel Brooks interested in him, which in turn led him to hire Lynch to do Elephant Man.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, think of what that tells us about Mel Brooks. For a man to look at that movie and say, yeah, I, the big Hollywood star, I'm going to hire this guy to make a several million dollar film. That's impressive to me.
Very strange bedfellows, Mel Brooks and David Lynch.
But there's a review of there's a new biography on Mel Brooks that's reviewed in the New York Times today, and they actually, it's mentioned that Mel Brooks took his name off the movie because he didn't want critics to think, oh, this is another Mel Brooks film, a comedy or something. You know, it's going to be a lot of fart jokes or something. He wanted, you know, people to really take an interest in David Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, I don't mean to truncate Chris's take on Eraserhead, but talking about Elephant Man, his next film, it really, you can really see the Francis Bacon influence. Because out of all the artists, Lynch seems to be most enamored with Francis Bacon. And he handled it perfectly in Elephant Man, I thought, and the master director of mood, I mean, it's all right there. It's been many years since I've seen it, but what are your impressions on that film?
Oh, I think that's a great film and underrated, you know, because of what came after it. It just seems like it's part of a different filmmaker's resume, and yet, it's a film shot in black and white. Your leading man is under, tons of makeup.
Right.
Anthony Hopkins, in an early comeback role for him when he was off the booze.
Right.
Anne Bancroft, the one vestige of Mel Brooks that's in the film, is Mrs. Brooks, and in a glamorous role which she rarely got to play.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tremendous, the sort of stuff that a studio executive would notice and say, we can trust this guy with some money, you know. he did all these things right. I have no doubt that there was that he had a pretty free hand, and then he delivered a movie that they were all happy with and that was nominated for Oscars.
Yeah. I read something interesting just a couple of days ago. Anthony Hopkins, he's been very complimentary of Lynch, his experience with Lynch as a director. But he his new movie is called Slipstream. It's his first directorial directorial debut. And I guess it premiered at a film festival. And the interviewer said, your film reminded me very much of David Lynch. And he took that as the ultimate compliment.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting.
No, it's I mean, yeah, there are few, there are very few artists in any era, but particularly now, whose names are adjectives.
Yeah, exactly.
And, Lynch has been that for about 20 years.
Yeah,
more than 20 years. Blue Velvet was the one that just put him on the map, and since then, it's like if you say this is like a David Lynch movie, everyone knows what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, right before Blue Velvet came Dune.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get Chris's thoughts on Eraserhead and The Elephant Man, if he had anything to add.
Well, I honestly, Eraserhead is one of those movies. It's interesting because Jamie mentioned how, you know, the sound was so dynamic from the beginning, and I think it's kind of obvious that would be how he gets into a film because, you know, like we said earlier, he started off as a painter.
Right.
And then moved into film. And, you know, for an artist, the reason to go from, you know, a two-dimensional canvas to film, basically a three-dimensional canvas, which also has the element of sound, you know, you would be a fool not to take advantage of every possible element that you have. And so it makes sense that from the beginning, you know, he was working with sound in that way.
Right. That's a good point.
I kind of have to sit with Sean as far as the movie itself goes because it's been many years since I've seen it. Elephant Man, on the other hand, I think is a lot like what we were talking about earlier too. It's such an emotional movie, mm-hmm. and you know, every month there's movies released from Hollywood that are trying to tap into that sort of emotion. You know, these tearjerkers that come out, and they don't come close to the kind of emotion that movie achieves. I mean, it makes you. If you don't cry at the end of that movie, it's a happy cry, too. You know, it's a very uplifting movie because Merrick is so pleased. You know, everyone's got all this pity for him, but he's had the time of his life, and he couldn't be more grateful to everyone for all that he's experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's one of the most uplifting movies I've ever seen.
That's right. That's a very good point, Chris. That's a very good point. Okay, Dune. Let's. I'm not. Hey. Don't come on. Who wants to start with Dune?
Well, you know, we really can't talk about David Lynch's Dune. I mean, this is a truly botched production, and the things that are Lynch-like in it, the sage-like thing that looks like, you know, a pudenda talking in a glass jar with wooden rails on it.
Yeah,
and
that
steampunk stuff.
Right.
That's to me Lynch. The bile that the fat guy spits on his victims. You know, the whole presence of Sting, but so little of what we were able to see, even in reconstructions, is what Lynch would have done with the film. He was in business with the wrong cat, Dino De Laurentiis, and he wasn't the first guy to get burned on this project. Before Lynch, Alejandro Jodorowsky was on board for years.
Oh,
in fact,
my!
His storyboards, if you Google around, you'll find this. Jodorowsky's storyboards wound up being half his crew went and made Alien, the other half went and made Blade Runner. That's the way Dune would have looked, and it would have been several years earlier than those films.
Oh gosh!
Wow! I didn't know that.
I interviewed Jodorowsky when Santa Sangre came out. This is maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was depressed. He couldn't work for years after he lost Dune. And finally Dune came out, and he went on opening day, you know, like with a hat over his head as if anyone would recognize him. And he sat there, and after about 10 minutes, he stood up, and he yelled to the theater, "This is an horrible movie!" And he walked out, and he felt better.
Well, David Lynch has said that Dune is his one film that he considers a failure.
And, you know, I'm sure that he didn't have Final Cut on that, but he has had Final Cut, no questions, on every movie since.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most curious thing on his resume, and it's the easiest to dismiss.
Mm-hmm. But right after that came Blue Velvet, which is one of his, if not the strongest film in his resume. And didn't that come out of a De Laurentiis deal? If he made Dune for De Laurentiis, he could make Blue Velvet?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's how I read it.
Yes.
You know, that, what can you say about Blue Velvet? Gosh, you know, to this day, it'll be on, and I'm flipping around, and there's some of Blue Velvet, and I'll watch it, and there are things in there that are still being ripped off by filmmakers. There's jokes that, you know, only having seen it 10 times dawn on me. The way, you know, the film begins, the narrative begins when Colin McLaughlin's Jeffrey Beaumont finds the ear.
Right.
Yeah. And then after the climax of the plot, we cut back to the two families, Jeffrey's family and Laura Dern's character's family, having a picnic of some sort. And we're introduced to that by the camera pulling away from someone's ear. So the film literally goes in one ear and out the other. You know, it can't be that I noticed that and Lynch didn't.
Right.
You know. But it wasn't until I'd seen it 12 times that I could say, oh my gosh, you know, I've seen that shot before.
There's always great new little things to discover in Lynch films. And
always.
In terms of performances, Blue Velvet, Dennis Hopper, one of the all-time great screen bad guys in that film, just a dynamic performance. Chris, what did you think of Blue Velvet?
I think Blue Velvet is, you know, obviously when people think of Lynch, I think they have a tendency to think Blue Velvet because... since then, either you've caught on to what he's doing with his films, or you kind of chalk it up as another David Lynch movie. That was
right.
One that really he kind of announced himself and said, "This is what you know. This is what I do." As a movie, I think it's perfect.
Yeah,
and I think from beginning
to
end, like Sean was describing, straight story. Earlier, I don't think that there's a moment in the movie that doesn't belong, and I just think it's perfect.
Yes, it is.
Mm. Yeah, for my money, of the Lynch feeling stuff, it's my favorite. You know, I mentioned Anthony Hopkins having his career revived. Dennis Hopper had his career revived with this film. He was making, you know, I think he was already doing video game voices in 1986.
Isn't this like the first major thing he had done? I mean, just...
Yeah.
Because isn't it the last movie where he sort of disappears?
Well, he worked, you know, but if you look at the films, he worked out of the country, you know...
Or My Science Project, that was one of them, I remember that.
When is The American Friend? Is The American Friend before or after Blue Velvet?
Oh, that's well before...
Yeah, but you see, that's out of the country.
Yeah.
He couldn't get work in the States. He had burned all the bridges.
Oh, yeah, he burned everything.
Well, that was a fantastic year for him, too, because if you think back, I think he had Blue Velvet and Hoosiers back-to-back.
Yeah.
No, he had River's Edge in there also.
River's Edge is 87.
You know,
that's 87.
Yeah.
That's the post-Blue Velvet bounce.
Right. And he's still living on that. I mean, you know, to this day, Dennis Hopper gets on TV, he could be selling Pepsi, and if he looks at you a certain way, it's Frank Booth.
I don't know that anyone would go out and buy Pepsi.
Hey, Frank Booth told me to buy Pepsi.
Yeah, well, they got Harvey Keitel selling Gatorade, and, you know, all
yeah,
I see is Bad
true.
Lieutenant.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Yeah, Dennis Hopper, amazing, amazing highlight of that film. And, but,
yes.
Plus, the cinematography is so sumptuous,
yeah.
And you know, I remember reading Pauline Kael's review of Blue Velvet upon its release, and she said it's almost like watercolors, like you could swoosh your fingers in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's just so vital and so alive, and not like anything else you'd ever seen. And you're right, Chris. I think it was Lynch's announcement of who he was as a filmmaker, like loud and clear.
So let's go to Jamie Duvall's favorite film, Wild at Heart.
It is my favorite film, actually. And part of it is sentimentality, because I saw it when I was not even 17. I was just graduating from high school. I was into
acting and films. And I saw this movie, and it kind of changed my life. It was the first movie that I felt anything is possible. This movie is everything. It's a horror, if you want to break it up by genres, it's a horror film, a musical, a romance, a road movie. And none of it felt out of place to me because it was consistent with the texture of his vision.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I responded so well to the contrast in the film. And I've never seen a film with such vivid contrast between, you know, love and hate, tenderness and violence. It was just very palpable to me. And as a 16-year-old watching that in the theater, it transported me in a way that I had never felt before.
You know, it also came out after the first season, I believe, or you know, concurrent with the first season of Twin Peaks.
That's right. It came out the end of that summer of 1990.
He had never been bigger.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, he was the pop culture moment. And yet, you know, if you kind of sit down and you don't know that and you look at these artifacts, the film and the TV series, you think, how did these get made? You don't think, oh, I can see that these were monster hits.
Right.
You think, who was, like, on what at the studio and where can I get some? And, you know, I mean, it's so specific. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
Right.
And it came to the United States under a tremendous cloud of expectation. And I'm not sure it lived up to it commercially. You know,
No, but it does stay with you. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, it just stays with you long after.
Look,
I think
Nicolas
it's a film
Cage.
That lives, yeah.
Nicolas Cage has still not quite shaken the Elvis thing. You know, there are many Nicolas Cages out there, and yet I'm not sure any of them is as powerful a character as Sailor, and I'm not sure that he's ever gotten away from it.
Yeah. I agree with that. I agree with you on that.
Chris and I talk a lot about Wild at Heart, and you share my affection for it, don't you, Chris?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you that they're two of the, for me anyway, like we said, the movie wasn't really embraced by American audiences, but for me, they are two of the most iconic, you know, lovers on screen. And it's interesting, we're talking about it, and I'm thinking about something that Ben Barinholtz was talking about, saying when on the heels of Eraserhead, how he said to David Lynch, you know, you're about 10 years ahead of your time. And then if you look at it, you know, 10 or so years after that, you know, you've got Twin Peaks, the television show is a cultural phenomenon. I mean, it was a huge TV show. And Wild at Heart comes out, wins the Palme d'Or, so it was true. I mean, this was the time when he was truly coming into his own.
Absolutely.
That's a good point. I think, so we've talked about Twin Peaks. I'd like to get to one movie we really haven't touched on at all, and it's actually one that is kind of a favorite of mine as I've gotten older, is Lost Highway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Lost Highway is kind of underrated. It's a very weird thing, and this is just so personal, it's going to mean nothing. I have two brothers-in-law. One of them looks like Bill Pullman, the other looks like Henry Rollins. And in that movie, Henry Rollins escorts Bill Pullman to a jail cell. And I was like, I always knew that guy would end up in trouble. I just never thought his brother would be the one to lock him up. You know?
No, that's...
It's all one big movie. You know?
Yeah, it's. I think, I mean, I like all the films. I like Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet, and I think this one. But I just, this is one of those you can go back and watch again and again. And like we said, you pick up something new all the time. You pick up not so much clues, but you just see new things. And I also like it because, like with Wild at Heart, he's working with Barry Gifford, and I think they have such a good working relationship between writer and director.
Yeah.
And I hope they'll do something again soon. I always look forward to it.
It's also, you know, the first time on Twin Peaks, he started evolving toward this, what I think of as like a Mobius strip narrative, where you're never sure which world you're in and which world is real. Blue Velvet, Elephant Man, Eraserhead, I suppose, but, you know, he abandoned that strategy as a narrative strategy for a better part of a decade.
Right.
In this movie, 20 years. In this movie, he's doing it explicitly, and that's what he's been doing more or less ever since, with the exception of the straight story.
Right.
So, you know, in a certain sense, it's kind of a the first of this, you know, if we speak of his career in phases, I think it's the first film of the current phase.
Right.
Well, we've got 5 minutes to cover Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire.
That's criminal. Oh.
You know, they're very similar films in ways. You know, I think of Inland Empire as the film that the producers of Mulholland Drive wouldn't let him make, if you could believe that those people would have said no to anything. And I always, you know, I realize I'm mentioning producers and money a lot because, you know, this is a business where $3 million is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when if you give someone $3 million, they can go off and you know, write, you know, a shelf of novels or fill a room with paintings or what have you. And for Lynch to do this type of work in this medium is extraordinary because
mm-hmm.
he needs someone to say, yeah, I'm going to give you $12 million to make a story I don't understand.
And,
yeah,
have
and I don't
cut.
Know how to market.
And he needs someone to say also, though, that he has to have final cut. You know, he can never go back. He's out of that area where he can go back and take orders or say, I want you to edit this scene or cut this out. He could never do that. I never see him working for another man.
Every interview
I've read
of him that asks him about that, you know, how do you fight the studio system so you don't have to compromise? And he just basically says, I just don't compromise. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And most of, I think all of his monies pretty much have come from the French. Like
yes.
The French have financed
mm-hmm.
most of his films.
Well, you know, I'm friendly with Gus Van Sant, who makes films here in Portland. And Gus, you know, had his flirtation with Hollywood, and he's just decided he'd rather make a $3 to $6 million film that's exactly what he's got playing inside his head
yeah.
than make a $30 million film and have to listen to what Brian Grazer thinks.
Exactly.
You know, and you, that's the difference between, you know, an artist and a commercial artist, I guess, in a crude way. But I also can't imagine anyone would hire a David Lynch or a Gus Van Sant and think, I'm going to teach this guy how to really make a movie. You know, you hire these people because they have a singular vision.
That's right.
Or anyone that could expect to take the film away from David Lynch and try and piece it together in a way that is not David Lynch. It
yeah.
seems like, mm-hmm. you know, no matter how you put a David Lynch, you know, footage together, it's not intended to be put together by anyone else at all.
Yeah. Well, this is a trick that, you know, they used to call this in the old days, editing in the camera. Hitchcock, Hawks, and Ford are three of the ones who were famous for only shooting what they needed.
Right.
They didn't shoot a bunch of stuff and say, we'll work it out in the editing room. This way they could protect their films from the producers and studio bosses because the only pieces to put together were the ones that the director wanted.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense cut any other way.
Right.
Yeah. Mulholland Drive for me actually is, it's like you were talking about with Lost Highway, Jerry. Mulholland Drive is one that kind of deepens in feeling and meaning to me each time I watch it. It seems to kind of reveal more and more layers the more time I invest in it. At first, I wasn't quite a fan of it, and now I've seen it maybe four or five times, and I'm looking forward to the next time I'm able to watch
yes,
it.
Likewise.
Yeah, so I think it's quite an extraordinary movie, especially given the fact that the majority of it is from the television pilot, I would assume, that failed.
Yeah.
And I think all the steamy kind of a few other scenes, most of the steamy things, were shot after the fact with extra financing from the French. But I think it's an amazing movie, actually.
Yes, it is.
Chris, what are your thoughts on Mulholland?
I like Mulholland for, you know, all the same reasons. I also like that it's, in my opinion, it's the slickest production of David Lynch, if you can call a David Lynch production slick. It's very beautiful and very, you know, the stock is very pretty, and it's also, I think, the richest of his movies, as far as it's got so much going on, there's so many characters, so many stories for you to get entangled with and just let your mind go with all these stories and what they mean, and I love it. It. Like you said, it gets, like Lost Highway, better every time you watch it.
Yeah.
You know, things.
Yeah, and you're speaking about pretty film stock. That brings us to the last Lynch film. Inland Empire. We have a minute. Jerry, you're the only one out of us who've seen it because we live in Podunk, Florida.
Yeah, well, I live in Silver Spring, Maryland. We have the AFI Silver, so they showed it, and I was very lucky to see it. I've, like I said to Martha, I've seen it once. I need to see it many more times, but it is, let me say this, it's 3 hours long. You're never bored.
Right.
I can't say that about that Pirates movie.
No.
Oh.
Well, you're never bored, but, you know, at times you're scratching at the walls in that way that Lynch can make you do.
Yeah, but it's never,
you know?
but it's always, at least, like you say, like, you're not bored. I mean, because it is a daunting running time. But he manages to, yes, you're scratching your head, you're banging your head actually against the seat next to you, but you're engaged. You are engaged in the film.
Absolutely. Mr. Levy, thank you so much for joining us for the last half hour of this broadcast.
Thank you, Sean.
Oh, it's been terrific fun. Any time, just drop me a note.
It's
been a great time. Thank you so much. All right, movie geeks, we are done with our David Lynch tribute.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
It's been a great time. Thanks, everyone out there, for supporting us for the show and listening in, and we'll see you next week with our celebration of The Sopranos and also an examination of if movies can inspire real-life violence. See you next week, guys.
See you next week. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Everybody.